All right, we're talking about the seventh chapter of the book of Daniel. Last time we introduced it a little bit, making a contrast. In chapter 2, a haughty king saw an image, and it was explained by Daniel. Here in chapter 7, Daniel, the man of God, gets dreams and visions of his own. And it was in the first year of Belshazzar. We talked about that. This would be the year 553, 552 B.C. And the first thing that he saw was these winds in verse 2, the four winds of heaven. We decided that those were destructive influences based on Old Testament and New Testament passages. Winds in our time are often considered destructive influences as well. We all know what tornadoes can do. Some of us have experienced that firsthand. So in verse 3, somebody asked me to put these winds back up there again. By the way, I should say to you that when we're done with this, you're going to have these slides if you want them. So you don't necessarily need to copy everything down, although I understand if you write things down, that helps in memory and so forth. So feel free to take all the notes you want to, but don't get yourself writer's cramp if you're just copying it because you think it won't be available to you. These slides should be available. I changed them a little bit tonight and probably will fine-tune them over time. So at the end, you will have access to them. Of course, they're on Denny's computer, so in a sense, you already have access to them. Anyway, we talked about those and how they spell news if we put north, south, east, northeast, west, and south together. And we saw that this was a scene of political strife. It's symbolic language. The Great Sea being the Mediterranean Sea, and we talked about how that was viewed as the center of the world. The waters were the people, as seen in Isaiah 59, which was read last week, and in Revelation 17, flatly says, the waters that you saw were people. So we got to verse 3. Verse 17 tells us, verse 17 is where we have the explanation of what this dream is. These four great beasts are four kings or kingdoms. And the same four world empires we saw back in chapter 2 very quickly and cursorily last week. So the first one was Babylon. We were in the process of talking about that. It's under the form of figure of a lion, and the lion is the king of beasts. We talked about Samson's riddle in Judges chapter 14, verse 18. Out of the eater came forth meat, and out of the strong came forth sweetness. And they came back with the answer to that riddle, which is, what is stronger than a lion? The Babylonian Empire was the strongest empire of its day. Let me just go ahead and read verse 4 to get it before our minds again. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given unto it. I think these eagle's wings, since the eagle is the king of the birds, are often viewed that way. That's why the bald eagle is our national emblem as far as the bird is concerned. They lost their power. These wings were plucked. We often talk about somebody having his wings plucked, which means a loss of power or influence. And that's what happened here. In chapter 4, you're well familiar with the story of Nebuchadnezzar, how he lost his power for 7 years until seven times or years passed over him. And then a man's heart was given unto it. I think that's when he gets his mind back. His intelligence back, his rationality back to make him a man again, and he's king then. And he says that I've learned that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. So that's the Babylonian Empire. I don't think we need to say any more about that. Do you have any questions on the Babylonian Empire here? If not, we'll go to verse 5. And Bill, go ahead. I think the man's heart is when Nebuchadnezzar gets his intelligence back after the 7 years. A man's heart is given back to it, and he decides that it's really true that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men. We have that reiterated 3 times in the 4th chapter. When he gets his rationality back, and he says the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, he probably dies not long after that, and the Babylonian Empire then begins to deteriorate. Okay, thanks for being on the ball, Chris. Appreciate it. Anything else over Babylon? And we can always go back to these if you want to. All right, let's... Oh, man's heart, I've got that reference to chapter 4, verse 34, which is what we were just talking about. Let's go to verse 5, which I believe represents the Medo-Persian Empire under the figure of a bear. Behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear, and it raised itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it, and they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. I think this is under the symbol of a bear because of the crushing power of a bear. Everybody's familiar with a bear. We live in a state where we actually have bears. Down in southern Missouri, there are quite a lot of bears. It's not unusual for people I know in southern Missouri to see a bear on their land once in a while. And these are tremendously powerful creatures. Now, here we're talking about black bears, which is nothing compared to a grizzly. But even a black bear can take its long claws and take a hold of a log that's only half rotten and just put that log into splinters. If you're walking through the woods and you see a log like that, you know that a bear did it. There's nothing else in the woods of Missouri that's going to do that to a log. So they can do some amazing things. And we're talking here about a crushing power, which is emblematic of the Medo-Persian Empire. Notice here that one side of it was raised up higher than the other. I think that's the Persian side, represented by King Cyrus, one of the greatest of the Persian kings. The Medes were the older kingdom, but the Persians were the stronger kingdom. So the Persians would be the side that's raised up as if to strike, but the Medes were the older kingdom. And we see here that this bear had three ribs between its teeth, in its mouth, between its teeth. This is the nourishing or strengthening that this empire got. All these empires need to go out and make conquerors of other nations so that they can maintain and even grow their own power. And, you know, that's what you do when you go to Jackstack. You put three ribs between your teeth there and you encourage your ability to have power.
Is there significance of three ribs?
Yes.
And what are these? Why is it three?
Okay.
And what is it from?
Okay. These three ribs, just like if you go to Jackstack and you eat three ribs, you're probably going to eat more than that, but you'll eat at least three. And you leave feeling nourished and strengthened because of what you've eaten there. The same thing is true here. These are conquered nations. The first three conquests that the Medo-Persian Empire made are the three ribs here, as I understand this. The first one was Lydia, and from Lydia they got gold. This was done in 546 B.C. I think you're familiar, perhaps, with the conquest of Lydia. This was ruled over by a very famous, wealthy king of ancient times. His name was Croesus, and we've had occasion to refer to him sometimes when we've talked about the letter to the city, to the church at Sardis in the New Testament, in Revelation chapter 3, because Sardis was the capital of Croesus, and it was located, you may recall, on the ridge of a mountain. There was a large mountain, Mount Tmolus, and this city of Sardis, the upper city of Sardis, the lower city of Sardis had grown down below because this ridge didn't have enough room. It's kind of like San Francisco, which is confined by water, and so it can only get to a certain size. So on this ridge of Mount Tmolus, they built this city of Sardis, which was thought to be completely impregnable because there were these sheer rock cliffs all the way around. And King Croesus thought that he was so secure there that when Cyrus came and waged war against him, he didn't even leave a watch because he thought that Cyrus had no way of getting there. But one of Cyrus' soldiers, after many days, saw a soldier from the city of Sardis accidentally drop his helmet down over the edge. And in a little declivity in that rock wall, he came down and got that helmet and went back up into the city of Sardis. So following that lead, the soldiers of Cyrus then went up that same little declivity and went over the wall into the city of Sardis, finding that a watch hadn't even been left, and they conquered the city of Sardis, and Croesus was put to death. And Cyrus said, this is legend here, I don't know if this actually happened, because a lot of times there's embroidery, historical embroidery on the facts, But it was said that King Cyrus said, I want you, told his soldiers, I want you to go to the body of King Croesus now. Because this guy was so, he was renowned in ancient history for being wealthy. He was so wealthy that he would have made Elon Musk look like he was on welfare. That's how wealthy he was. So now that he's dead, Cyrus said, I want you to go to the body of Croesus and just fill his, open his mouth open and fill his, the body cavity with molten gold until it's running out of his mouth. And then at last, we will be able to say that Croesus had his fill of gold, because he never could get filled up with it during his lifetime. He always was grasping for more and more and more. Lydia was the first of these three nourishing ribs, and they got gold from there. The second one was Babylon, and this conquering, we may or may not have referred to it last week, but that happened in 539 BC. They also got more gold from Babylon. This is when Cyrus comes to the city of Babylon. Soldiers go under the city wall because the river Euphrates runs there. 100 miles north of Babylon, they had detoured the Euphrates River into a swamp and just let most of the water run off over there. So the soldiers were able then to walk under the city wall of Babylon in just, I think, thigh or knee-deep water and get in there, unlock the gates, and they went in and took over the city of Babylon that night. This is the night of the handwriting on the wall, as depicted in Daniel chapter 5, 539 B.C. And this was taken over. The Persian Empire took over. Okay, so this was number two, the second rib. The city, or the empire of Babylon, was taken over here. And then finally, the third rib is Egypt, from which they got horses and chariots. This happened in 525 BC. So I believe that these are the three ribs between the teeth in the mouth of the Medo-Persian Empire. And with every one of them, they became stronger. Questions, comments, thoughts over verse 5. We doing okay? All right, let's go to 6. And we can always go back. If we think we're going too fast, just tell me to slow down. 6 is the Macedonian or the Greek Empire, as I understand it. After this, verse 6, I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had the back of it, had upon the back of it 4 wings of a fowl. The beast had also 4 heads, and dominion was given to it. This leopard has 4 wings, so it can move twice as fast as the guy with eagle's wings under the Babylonian Empire. This one can move twice as fast, and I believe that's referring to the rapidity and rapacity of Alexander the Great, because this truly was an amazing historical occurrence, the blinding speed of Alexander the Great in a 12-year period of time, but found in this period between 356 and 323 BC when he died, Alexander went forth conquering and to conquer. And he would do this, he was totally devoted to this, and he was good at it. So they say, and I don't know if these numbers are right, again, there is such a thing as historical embroidery, but we're told that Alexander in one battle, for instance, had 30,000 men versus Darius, who had 600,000 men, and Alexander won anyway. 30,000 versus 600,000, but Alexander won anyway. And he had all kinds of tactics that he would use, feints and stratagems of one type or another. But in 12 years, he conquered part of Europe and most of Asia in an imperialism unparalleled in human history. I still don't know if anybody has ever matched this. There are 4 heads here, and I believe these refer to Alexander's generals, because Alexander died at a very young age. He died at the city of Babylon, which he was hoping to make into, I believe, the 16th Alexandria. He already had a bunch of Alexandrias. He would conquer a major city and then change its name to Alexandria, or in some cases they were built up. There's a very famous Alexandria in Egypt, as you know. But he was at Babylon, and he wanted to make it, I believe, the 16th or 17th Alexandria. But he died while he was still there at a very young age, just in his 30s. And these 4 upon Alexander's death, there were 5 at the very first, but almost immediately there were only 4. And these were his generals, and I'll just give you their names. Seleucus was the one who was given the territory in Syria and the east. Ptolemy, of course, was down in Egypt. Lysimachus had Asia Minor, and Cassander had the area around Greece. Cassander is interesting because he married Thessalonica, who was Alexander's sister, the only daughter of Philip of Macedon and the sister of Alexander the Great. And the city of Thessalonica that we read about in the Bible is named after Thessalonica. Today it's called Salonica, but still there, still the same place. So these, as I understand it, are the four heads that are being referred to here. Any questions over verse 6? We doing all right?
Will you give the territories?
Yeah. So Lucas had Syria and the east, and Ptolemy had Egypt. Lysimachus had Asia Minor, and Cassander had Greece. And yes, and we're going to see that this is all going to boil down, as far as the Bible is concerned, and the things that are germane here, it'll eventually boil down to the Seleucids in Syria and the Ptolemies in Egypt, and they're going to use the nation of Israel as a tug of war later on. Sometimes one of them will own it, and sometimes the other one will own it. But Israel is like the rope in the tug of war between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. We'll see more of that. What we're dealing with here, and you probably have a sense of this, is overlays. Remember when we used to use an overhead projector before we had all this fancier technology? Sometimes we put a map on the overhead projector, and that would be like chapter 2, which we talked about last week. And now here in chapter 7, it's like we're leaving that map there, but we're putting another overlay on top of it and getting a little more detail. And then in chapter 8, we'll have another overlay on top of that with more detail. And then in chapters 11 and 12, we'll have another overlay on top of that and with more detail yet. So that's the way the book of Daniel is built. First, that's why I called chapter 2 the backbone of biblical prophecy. And then we have several overlays over the top of that. So that's more, and eventually you'll have more information than you want about the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. Okay, we're ready to go on. And remember, you can always go back. As I said last time, this is kind of like mathematics, in that if we miss a building block along the way, then we may be confused later. So don't be afraid to go back if we need to. Paul's got something.
Well, it's probably not something we can figure out, but these are going to be descendants of, is there any way to trace these descendants, like from Ham and, Noah?
Yeah. They can be traced.
Can they? Okay.
Yeah. They can. And everybody comes from Noah, just like everybody comes from Adam. Noah came from Adam, so we all came from Adam, but there was a population bottleneck there on the ark. Only 8 people survived the flood, so everybody now is descended from Noah. And he had 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And yes, we have Semitic races from Shem. We have Hamitic races from Ham. And we have Japhetic races from Japheth. And the 10th chapter of the book of Genesis, of course, outlines this and tells us how all the world was populated after the time of the power of Babel, the Tower of Babel, by these 3 main sources of people. And there's a book written by Bill Cooper that outlines that, not the Bill Cooper that you may know over in Illinois, but a different Bill Cooper, where he outlines that very thoroughly. And that's not the only book as well, but it's put there in a very interesting way, I think. So yes, these are going to rule various areas of the world that were populated by those various peoples. That's right. Any other questions, comments, or thoughts? Everybody is from one of those 3, Shem, Ham, or Japheth. All right, let's go on to the fourth of these empires under a fourth beast. After this I saw in the high visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it, and it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. This, I believe, as I've already got on the screen there, is Rome. This is following right along with the image that we looked at in chapter 2. This was diverse. I guess Daniel looked through the zoo and couldn't find anything that corresponded to what he really saw here. Remember, this is something that Daniel is experiencing as if it was real. I mean, all of his physical responses, his emotions, his heartbeat, his pulse, and all this is just as if he's seeing something that's real. I have used the illustration of a theater in the round where you just go in, and I think they have one of these at World of Fun. I know they have one down in Disney World in Florida, and they've got one in Disneyland in Los Angeles, Anaheim area. And probably most of you have been in a theater in the round where you just go in there, and what they have done is taken cameras pointing in every direction and filmed simultaneously experiences, like maybe you're going on a fire truck through New York City. And you look in front of you, you're going down the street, you look in back of you, and the scenery is receding. Beside you, the buildings are going by. And then they turn, and people will grab a hold of the rails, even though you're just standing there in that theater, but you're stationary, but people will grab a hold of the rail in front of them because you're making a turn here. There's so much motion, you feel like you're experiencing this. Or they'll put you on a plane with these cameras, and they're flying over the Alps, and then suddenly there's a canyon that drops away in front of you, and your stomach comes up in your mouth, even though you're not moving at all, but you're involved in the action because you're seeing all this. This is the way I think it was for the Apostle John. It's not happening to him literally and physically, but it's so real to him that I can see him ducking down, Daniel or the Apostle John, any of these prophets would have this experience as though it was really happening. It seemed that real. So he's looking for a way, as I deem it, to describe this fourth, and it's so awful that there's nothing in the zoo that corresponds to it. So he just says it's a diverse beast. That's the best he can do. He can't describe it by something that we know as an animal, a lion, a bear, or a leopard. It's that bad. It does have iron teeth, as he says, and I take this back to the strong as iron, which is depicting the Roman Empire back in chapter 2, and iron was the metal symbol that was used to describe it there. Also, it's interesting in Revelation chapter 13, when this same empire is described, it is described there under the symbol of a leopard, a bear, and a lion combined. It had all of those characteristics tied up together in one beast. So that's another way of putting it. We see that this creature had 10 horns. Now, a horn is a symbol of power. That's the reason the expression is used. When you take a steer, if it's got its long horns on there, and those horns haven't been pulled down as we do sometimes by putting weights on them, so they'll grow down and they won't be as deadly, or you just pull them and take the horns off completely. But if it hasn't had that done, those long horns that's where the power of that animal is. That's what he can gore you with. That's where the strength of the animal is. So you take a steer with a 6-foot span on those horns, and it's deadly. My grandpa, and I'm talking about my paternal grandpa now, some of you knew him from years ago. He used to live with us from the time I was, I think, 11 years old until I left home, and then he continued on. I think he lived with my parents for about 10 years or so, from 62 to 72, and when he died. Anyway, he used to come with us on Sunday morning at church. He'd sit right back there by Tabitha and Gertha Dickerson, who you also have to be my age to remember. But he had a very interesting life. He had built ships during World War I on the East Coast, but he also had been a cowboy in Texas. He was from Canadian Texas and had ridden on a horse taking care of these longhorn steers with these horns. And he said, the worst thing you can do is get off your horse. If you're ever in that situation, don't get off your horse. They'll gore you to death and not think a thing about it. So that's where the power is. It's in the horns, and that's why this is depicted with 10 horns here. So these are powers. They are the powers of European society at a given point. They are really the iron mixing with the miry clay that we had back in chapter 2. And I'll just put here what I deem these 10 powers or 10 horns to be. Although you could dispute a couple of these if you wanted to, but I've looked at lots of lists that other people have made up, and this is I think the best I can do on these issues. These are the tribes of Europe, as we might call them. The Huns, the Ostrogoths, the Visigoths, the Franks, the Vandals, the Swabes and Alans, the Burgundians, the Heruli and the Rugians, the Angles and the Saxons, and the Lombards. I'm just going to say here that this round number 10 is not absolute. It's more like an average. It's an appropriate symbol for these nations, but anytime you have a number in the Bible like a 10 or a 100 or a 1,000 that is round, it's not necessarily intended to convey statistical information as much as just to give you an idea of an approximation. This is an appropriate symbol for these nations which have more often than not numbered 10. So it's like 10 is the medium of all the oscillations over time, because you can get down in the weeds on this and say, well, at this time there were 11, at this time there were 9, but 10 is the medium. By the way, Sir Isaac Newton pointed out, and he was not only a great scientist, but he wrote a lot more about the Bible than he did about science itself. He was a great believer in the Bible. Isaac Newton pointed out that the number 10 might be justified as the number of kingdoms at the time that these horns are introduced into history, and that very well may be right. But these numbers are used sometimes just because that's the way we think of that particular thing, like the apostles. The apostles of Jesus Christ are sometimes called the 12, even when there were only 11 of them. I'm sure you've probably noticed that. Like in John chapter 20, verse 24, Judas was already dead, and yet Thomas is called one of the 12. Well, if you count Judas, who's already dead, as one of the 12, then there are 12. Or if you're counting Matthias, like in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 5, Jesus, after his resurrection, was seen of Cephas, then of the 12. Well, there were only 11 after his resurrection. Matthias was named later as an apostle, and he was a witness of Jesus. So you could say that since Matthias saw him, that's the 12. But really, I think it's fair to say that sometimes they're referred to as the 12, even when there were only 11 of them. So I'm just making a point about the way numbers are used in the Bible. We had the Hunnic hordes converting to a form, if I can use the word very generally, of Christianity known as Arianism. And also you had a general amalgamation of Oriental mysticism and paganism and Judaism, called Christianity, beginning about 325 A.D., when Constantine at the Council of Nicaea was making the Christian faith the state religion of the Roman Empire. So we come through time then, and over time, we get modern names for these horns. I don't mean that number 1 corresponds to number 1 and number 10 corresponds to number 10, but just in general, these tribes of Europe become what we are more familiar with the modern names of the 10 horns: Germany, Austria, Holland, Belgium, France, Spain, Italy, Switzerland, Portugal, and Great Britain. These are the names that we recognize as Europe today. So they would be the more modern names of the 10 horns. And again, you'll have these slides if you want them, so no need to write that all down unless you just want to. Anything else over verse 7? Okay, let's look at verse 8. I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of man, and a mouth speaking great things. This little horn that we have just read about in verse 8, I believe to be, and you may or may not agree with this, but I'll tell you why I believe it. I believe this to be the papal dynasty. That is, the series of popes throughout the years. There have been 266 of them, counting the one that we have now, Francis. The papal dynasty, I believe, is this power that's known as the little horn, which was little when it started, but then it grew. You know, in the New Testament, the highest officer in the church is called an elder, a presbyter, a bishop, an overseer, a pastor, a shepherd. These six names in English come from three words in Greek, and all three of the words in Greek and all six of the words in English refer to the same office, the eldership in the church. But over time, the people in the church began to accumulate more power until you had a bishop as distinguished from the elders. We see this as early as 110 AD when Ignatius was writing his letters. Ignatius was going to Rome to be martyred, and on his way there he wrote a series of letters and talked about that the elders should be attuned to the bishop as the strings are to the harp. And so they were already making a distinction that the New Testament did not make between a bishop and an elder. Well, this continued on and grew until eventually you had one bishop over an entire congregation. Pretty soon you had one bishop over a city, and they began to be referred to as popes, these guys that were high up in the church as it was understood at that time. So there were many popes at this point. There was a pope of Jerusalem and a pope of Constantinople, a pope of Alexandria, a pope of Rome, and so on and so forth. But long story short, eventually the Pope of Rome won the contest, and it had become a contest, a political contest, just as political as anything could be. And he won out in 533. I've got ahead of myself a little bit there. I'm sorry. The spiritual power of the church became vested in the Pope. This was a very gradual development. No one generation of people would have stood for that much change. But eventually, there was just one pope. But by the way, I have, I'm going to show you this book. I have an Oxford Dictionary of Popes, which is very handy. This contains a biography of 265 of those popes I wrote in Francis after after Benedict was put out of office. I still have questions about how come he was kicked out of office, but anyway, he resigned, and Francis is the 266th one. But if you just want to know about any pope, you can look it up in here, and it'll tell you. The early ones are real interesting, because what they did is when they developed the papacy, then they went back and kind of tried to invent who was a pope when, clear on back to Peter, so that Peter could be the first one, and then you come up, and in these early portions of it, it will say that the monarchical episcopate had not yet emerged at Rome. So this guy was the pope, but there was no papacy yet, in essence, is what it's saying. But they have done as good a job as they could to try to create a papacy, starting with the Apostle Peter and all through the years. So I just wanted to point that out, because you might be helped by that book if you're looking into this type of thing. The first of these three, which I put up a minute ago, were Italy, France, and Spain. Or, if you prefer, the Vandals, the Ostrogoths, and the Lombards. But I'm thinking we probably prefer the modern names. The Vandals, the Ostrogoths, and the Lombards, or Italy, France, and Spain, he was able to take over those three of the ten horns and to use them, because the Pope didn't really have any power of his own. It was just that people who believed that he had authority from God gave their power to him. So when people later began to think that he didn't have authority from God, then he began to lose power. But in his heyday, the Pope's armies were the armies of Europe. Italy, France, and Spain, as you know, today are still more Catholic than most countries. I don't feel good about talking about somebody else's religion, but I just feel like we have to explain what I believe is the meaning of this little horn. And I hope you can take it in that kind of a spirit. Rome was in Italy, of course, and Italy still today surrounds Vatican City. Or Vatican City State, as it's sometimes called. Vatican City is not a part of Rome. It's not a part of Italy. It's a country all its own, the smallest country in the world. 110 acres, population 840. And there's a line on the asphalt there where you cross from Rome into Vatican City. All you got to do is step over that line, and you're in a completely different country, and you don't even need a passport to step over that line, because everybody understands that this is a tiny little country. The King of France for many years was known as the eldest son of the church. In other words, this is the king that the Pope can depend on. The Popes even lived in France for a while. When people got sick of them in Rome in the 14th century, they lived in France for going close to 100 years. at Avignon, France, and the Papal Palace is still there today in Avignon, France. So France and the papacy were very closely connected. In fact, the French Revolution eventually occurred because France was so Catholic. In places like Germany and England, you had a Reformation that let off some of the steam. But there was no Reformation in France because they had Louis XIV, the Sun King, who was extremely Catholic. He was the king of the French nation for 73 years, and he ruled with an iron hand. So when France finally got sick of Catholicism because of the abuses of the clergy, they just threw the baby out with the bathwater and turned to atheism. And it seems to me, in all these years talking with people, it seems to me that Roman Catholicism has been responsible maybe for more atheism than any other one entity. Time after time after time, I've talked to people who say, well, I was raised as a Catholic, but I'm an atheist now. Because they're asked to believe such ridiculous things, and a certain percentage of them just say, well, I can't believe that. I just renounce it all. So France, Italy, and Spain were the places where the papal power was successfully challenged last. And we'll see that perhaps more as we go through these things. But when did the papacy really begin? When did the Pope have his spiritual power recognized? I give the year on that 533 AD. This is the time when Justinian, who was the Byzantine emperor, acclaimed Rome as the head of all the churches. The bishop of Rome, who was John II at that time, was declared to be the universal bishop. That means he's over all other bishops. He was called the Lord of the Church, or the Papa, or the Pope, as we would put it in our language. He was called the Holy Father, and he's still called the Holy Father today. And this is what gave the saints into the hand of the little horn. All he needed was more power than political power to execute his enemies. And you may or may not be familiar with the donation of Pepin in 756 AD. This is where he begins to accumulate his political power in earnest. The donation of Pepin was land. The Papal States, you've probably heard of the Papal States that run clear across Italy. He comes into this possession of political and temporal power when he takes over this land and becomes, in addition to being the Pope, he's a king too. And for many years then, the popes were also kings. In 774 AD, Charlemagne defeated the Lombards and gave their dominion to the Pope. And then, interestingly, in 800 AD, Charlemagne, as the Holy Roman Emperor, was crowned by the Pope. This is an important day, I think. Christmas Day, December 25th, 800 AD. When Charlemagne is crowned by the Pope, because you cannot confer authority unless you have authority. And by allowing him to crown the Holy Roman Emperor, they were saying that he had authority himself. This is how, little by little, the Roman Church became the most powerful force in Europe. And he was a little horn with a look more stout than his fellows. That's down in verse 20. And I guess since we're on this little horn, maybe it's best just to look at what the rest of the chapter says about him so we have the complete picture from this chapter. At the end of verse 20, it says, whose look was more stout than his fellows? So he's gaining this power, and he's becoming stouter and stouter. And that's not all this book, this chapter says about the papacy. To come to the other end of that, we started in 533. I'd go to the time of Napoleon, the French Revolution and Napoleon for the end of this time. On December the 2nd, 1804, Napoleon, and we'll talk more about this later, but Napoleon made an old sick pope make a trip of 1,000 miles by the travel in that day, which was just in a stagecoach type vehicle on terrible muddy roads. He made this old sick pope make that journey to crown Napoleon as the emperor of the French. All the others had gone to Rome to be crowned by the pope, but Napoleon turns that around and makes the pope come to him just to show that he has the power to do that. And then when it comes time for the pope to crown Napoleon, which has been to every Holy Roman Emperor has been crowned by the pope through the years. That's what legitimizes it. So that's why Napoleon has the pope there. But then Napoleon, when it comes time, and the Pope says, receive the crown, Napoleon turns, he snatches that crown out of the hands of the Pope, turns his back on the Pope, turns his back on the altar in Notre Dame Cathedral. You're familiar with this cathedral. It just burnt a few years ago and they just rebuilt it. Same cathedral. Every seat is filled. And the audience gasps because they can see what's happening. Napoleon then takes that crown, he holds it above his own head, and he crowns himself instead of letting the Pope crown him. What's Napoleon doing? He's saying that the Pope has lost his power. The Pope is not what he used to be. And that's right. And he never has regained that power, and I believe he never will regain that power. Although the papacy will exist until the end of time, if I understand 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 correctly, the papacy will exist until he is destroyed by the brightness of the Lord's coming. So today, he's already been back down to Vatican City State, smallest country in the world, again. 110 acres. A lot of you come from families where your grandpa had more land than that, but that's what the Pope's got in our time. 110 acres, population 840. But when the Pope appears in public today, he still carries the scepter, which is the symbol of his temporal power, because he never gave it up. It was taken from him, but he never gave it up willingly, and he kind of pretends that he still has it. And he does have a lot of influence over hundreds of millions of people in our time. He carries the scepter, and he still carries the cross, which indicates his spiritual power. So I believe that the papacy is the leader of the Babylon that the Apostle John talks about in the book of Revelation. I believe the papacy is the man of sin that the Apostle Paul talks about in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And I believe the papacy is the little horn here in Daniel chapter 7, verse 8. Verse 8 says that he had a mouth speaking great things. And verse 11 says that he spoke great words. And in verse 25, we see that he shall speak great words against the Most High. So the rest of this chapter is basically about him and his situation. He shall speak great words against the Most High. This is speaking of blasphemy if he speaks great words against the Most High. The Most High is God. And of course, the blasphemous arrogance of the popes is well known. Papal claims to divine authority are well documented. The papacy claims to be uniquely ordained by God to represent God on the earth. And many popes have not only claimed to take the place of God on the earth, but even to be equal with God and even to be God. Let me give you just a few examples here, although there are many that could be quoted. Pope Leo XIII on June 20th, 1894, we hold the place of Almighty God on earth. Imagine the audacity of even saying that much, but it gets worse. Pope Pius IX, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Seemed like somebody else said that who had the right to say it, and now for a mere man to say it, it just gets weirder and weirder. Pope Pius XI, April 30th, 1922, you know that I am the Holy Father, the representative of God on the earth, the vicar of Christ, which means that I am God on earth. Yeah. And again, I don't take any pleasure in telling this or renouncing somebody else's religion, and yet we have to tell the truth about this situation. There was a guy by the name of Cardinal Manning who was a good friend of Pope Pius IX. He said something that I agree with. He said, the papal church is totally supreme, or it is nothing or worse than nothing. It's an imposture and a usurpation. That is, it is Christ or Antichrist. And I agree with that. It is Christ or Antichrist. It has to be one or the other. The papacy has openly claimed to be a law unto itself. It has openly claimed to have authority to change existing laws, whether ecclesiastical or civil, and even to change the laws of Christ. Pope Gregory IX, he said, the Pope is, quote, is said to have a heavenly power, and hence he changes even the nature of things and can make something out of nothing. A judgment which is null, he makes to be real. In the things which he wills, his will is taken for reason, nor is there anyone to say to him, why dost thou this? For he can dispense with the law. He can turn injustice into justice by correcting and changing the law, and he has the fullness of power. You know, it's a terrifying thing Sometimes you talk to Mormons, and you know, when the Book of Mormon came out in 1830, Joseph Smith said it was the most correct book on earth. So sometimes I ask Mormons, if it was the most correct book on earth, how come it's been changed thousands of times since it was originally put out? They'll say, oh yes, but who changed it? Because the man that changed it, the prophet, seer, and revelator of the Mormon church, he has the right to change it. He can say black today and white tomorrow, and he is right both times. When the prophet speaks, the thinking has already been done. To me, that's just terrifying. A much greater respect for authority than for truth. And the papacy makes that same claim for itself. This is the reason why that if the Pope regained his power in our time, you wouldn't be safe, because the Pope would never tolerate you. He wants everybody to be a follower of his. In God's plan, we have checks and balances. There's a balance of power in God's plan. I was appointed as an evangelist by the elders here. And when I go out in the world and do my work and among churches, complaints about me come back to my elders. Hopefully they don't get too many, but I wouldn't know how many complaints they may get about my work. The point is, I am accountable to my elders, and everybody knows that. So they would be very free to speak with my elders if they felt the need to. And my elders have the right to say that I am no longer an evangelist. Same thing with elders. Elders are appointed by evangelists. Accusations against elders go to evangelists, and an evangelist can hear the accusations and take what's appropriate activity. An evangelist can remove an elder from his office. Point is that in the Lord's church, as designed by God in the New Testament, everybody is accountable to somebody. There's no autonomy. There is a balance of power. And by the way, the founding fathers of our nation who wrote our Constitution intentionally spread the power out over three branches of government because they understood human ambition. They understood what Lord Acton said, that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So they gave three branches of government to spread out the power with checks and balances, not just to make us a government, but to protect us from our government. And that Constitution has served us well now for hundreds of years. But with the papacy, you don't have any check, because he is able to do and say what he wants to. I'll give you another one here. Pope Nicholas, and this will be the last one, I think, last one tonight anyhow, 1447 to 1455, so 15th century. No marvel if it be in my power to change times and laws. Now, Daniel 7:25 says that he shall think to change times and laws. And Pope Nicholas says, no marvel if it be in my power to change times and laws, to alter and abrogate laws, to dispense with all things, yea, even with the precepts of Christ. I can dump a precept of Christ if I feel like it's not right for our time and our situation. I got the authority to do that. So this is a little bit terrifying. The little horn, the Pope, is the judge and can be judged by no one. And in their heyday, these popes were kings as well as priests, and they exercised their power with an iron rod. They claimed to be subject to no power on earth and to be the King of Kings, and for ages they acted accordingly. Well, I think that was somebody's alarm that went off. Time to wake up, Ronnie. I know you woke up at 3 this morning, but I guess we go right to the announcements.